From Relay FM, this is Connected, episode 33. Today is Tuesday, March 31st, 2015. Connected is brought to you by these awesome sponsors. Lynda.com, where you can instantly stream thousands of courses created by industry experts. Screens, which is a great family of applications that allows you to access your computers from wherever you are. And Wealthfront, the automated investment service that makes it easy to invest your money the right way. I'm not Mike Hurley, but I'm your co-host, Stephen Hackett, and I'm joined across the world, standing at 6'1", hailing from Rome, Italy, Mr. Federico Vitigi.
Hey, Stephen.
Hey. It's it's like deep in basketball season here, so I thought I'd go for like a height and where you're from, like they do for basketball games. The problem is I don't know how tall our guest is, who is just one state away from me. I'm going to say that David is 6 foot tall and hails from the town of Underscore. That's close.
That's pretty close. Right.
That's pretty close. How you doing, David?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Yeah, we're glad to have you. So Mike's at the UL conference. He's not dead. We're not going to make that joke today, probably. He's at a conference. So, David, you were very gracious to step in. And we have a lot of things to talk about today. So I'd say that we're just going to jump right in. And Federico, the follow-up is basically all your fault this week.
What did I do?
Your wireless, needing to turn the wireless off at night, has spawned more email than almost anything we've talked about in the 2 years we've done a show together. Like, it won't stop. So lots of emails came in. We're only going to talk about a few of them. The first one is from listener Diggory, and Diggory suggests a second wireless network to have Wi-Fi separate from the DSL router, so you can put the Wemo in between. So basically, you could leave the internet on all the time, so the Wemo switch can talk to the internet, so you can turn it off and on over LTE, and then the wireless would be downstream of that, so you could turn the wireless on and off, but leave the internet always on, which is a... just complicated enough to really make
not
it lo-
sure
love
I'm
it.
Following.
Well, dude.
Okay, what am I supposed to do here?
So, is the wireless coming out of the same?
Yes.
So what you would do is you would buy like an AirPort Extreme or something. And,
oh, I need to buy stuff.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Mike can buy for you, and you plug that into the Wemo, right? And so the Wemo goes on and off. So like, if imagine the Wemo the bridge, right? So the bridge goes up, it closes, and the wireless doesn't work anymore. But the Wemo is still attached on the other end to internet. It's pretty brilliant. I like that it has a lot of moving pieces. It's a little Rube Goldberg, but I think it's pretty clever. Mm-hmm. I will say, though, Ted's suggestion is much simpler. Federico, do you want to describe this Amazon link for our listeners?
Yes. I first opened this link last night, and I couldn't quite figure out what was going on. So this is an extension cord with a foot switch. And basically, there's like an American cable, because I can tell from the plug. And there's like a little capsule in the middle. And you're supposed to like, you know, press this little switch with your foot. And I'm guessing that it cuts off, you know, the power. And now I'm not sure, am I supposed to keep this under my... you know, just under my bed, and then when I want to, you know, turn off my Wi-Fi, I just press this foot switch before sleeping.
My thought was you put it under your pillow, and so when your head hits the pillow, and it probably won't cause any fires when you sleep. I think that's the way to do it.
Or maybe just, you know, maybe I can just activate it with my hand, keep it on my nightstand, and when I go to sleep, I just, you know, and the Wi-Fi goes off. I don't know, it's an idea.
It is an idea.
It's an idea. It's another idea.
It's another idea.
We also received, Stephen, a suggestion for an app to use. A lot of people I know emailed you correctly, because I always tell people to send emails to Stephen, which is, you know, the right way to send feedback. So there's a Netgear app for iOS.
Yeah.
I didn't know this, and it looks horrible.
It's like, pretty bad.
It is the kind of Netgear app that you would expect Forstall to design.
It's not even taller. It's like iPhone 4 size still.
There's black bars in the screenshot on top and the bottom. and there's a bunch of I'm guessing icons that looks like icons from Windows, and you can, you know, access parental controls, wireless settings, guest access, My Media, which I'm not sure what you're supposed to do with this. And there's folders. You can, you know, you can browse your media server.
Yeah.
It looks. Thanks for, you know, the recommendation. I mean, there's also the rotation lock in the status bar. And one thing that really bothers me is that the battery goes. You know, if you take a look at the screenshot, you could tell that this guy was going through, you know, a serious process, because the battery goes 35%. 36, 37, 38. So he took a lot of screenshots, this person.
Yeah.
The screenshots are also from iOS 6. Because it doesn't have the dots in the top left.
Oh,
doesn't
yeah.
have the dots.
Yeah, yeah, look how weird those lines look now. I actually really hated the dots when iOS 7 came out, but now I've come to appreciate them looking back on the screenshot.
But do people say, like, I have three dots? Because I still hear people saying, of course, in Italian, I still have three bars.
I hear
so
the same.
They still call them bars, but it's dots.
Right. I hear the same thing. It's it's something that's really tearing society apart, I think. So the next bit of feedback, I actually put a dropper link in the show notes, basically just copying Dan's email for the world to read. So sorry, Dan. But he basically wrote this email saying that you could script this sort of stuff, which of course Federico is right up your alley. I didn't really kind of get what he was, you know, I didn't pick up what he was laying down here, but do you have some ideas on how you could somehow script your Wi-Fi to turn on and turn off at night?
Yeah, I could use Python to basically interact with my local Wi-Fi IP address. There's a couple of modules or, you know, on Pythonista that you could install or maybe even have already in the app. I guess I could put together some, you know, some workarounds to mess around with my Wi-Fi. I just don't want to, because I know that I would break things somehow, and, you know, I would rather just have a local timer. Again, just give me a local timer on the Wemo. I'm sort of giving up on turning off my Wi-Fi, so I needed to explain my girlfriend our problem. And so I'm just, again, thanks for all the feedback, but I'm just giving up, because there's no, like, the kind of solution that I want is not possible right now with the Wemo, which, by the way, I'm still using with my espresso machine. And today I was just driving home, and I was at a, you know, in my car, and I just pressed the Wemo icon, and like the button to turn on the switch, and when I walked into my apartment, I just went into the kitchen, made some espresso, and it was amazing. I mean, it's always amazing when I walk into my home house, and, you know, the espresso machine is ready.
Right.
So cool.
A robot.
Wi-Fi. Yeah, the Wi-Fi. I'm giving up on the Wi-Fi.
I think that's probably for the best. So we also spoke about teletext, and Ned points us to, I guess it's Mintel. Is that how you pronounce that, Federico or David?
Mintel. It's like Intel with mint.
That's what I thought, but it's French, so maybe it's.
Oh, maybe it's Mintel. I'm not sure how I can do it.
I never
French
studied
accent.
French. David, do you know French?
Nope, just Spanish. Only that barely.
Yeah, that's how I am. So this was another online service available through telephone lines, and it was primarily
Mintel, it's Minitel.
So basically it required a terminal. So there's a Wikipedia page, like, look at this hardware, this thing is
I knew it,
not good looking. I mean, it's I want one, but it's not good looking.
Of course you do.
But so it's pretty cool. You should check out the Wikipedia article. Federico, if someone wanted to find this link and the other links we've discussed, where would they go?
Well, they can go to page 33 of their teletext.
Done.
Just press 33 on the TV remote, and you will be taken to the show notes in the glorious interface of the teletext.
Yeah.
Or if you're, you know, a little more old fashioned, you could go to relay.fm/connected/33.
Awesome. So we have an announcement before we move out of follow-up. we have connector shirts for sale over on Teespring. And it plays on the joke of I've been beta testing things for a couple weeks. Glorious artwork by our friend Forgotten Towel, who does all the artwork here at Relay, all the show art and the web design and all that stuff comes out of his brain. And he was very kind to do a shirt for us. You should definitely go check it out. You've got until April 12th to order. So another 12 days or so from recording. We'll be reminding you again. We would definitely love if you guys would check that out. It helps us do our thing, and you get to look super handsome or super beautiful all at the same time. It's a win-win, as they say, yeah. Guys.
Yeah. If you don't buy a t-shirt, you will never receive new episodes again.
Wow. So
it's in your best interest buy t-shirts.
I can't enforce that. But you will look good. Some really nice colors, men's and women's cuts, so I definitely go check them out. Guys, we should take a break.
Okay.
And thank our friends at lynda.com. You guys know Lynda. They're the online learning platform with over 3,000 on-demand video courses to help you strengthen your business, technology, or creative skills. Lynda.com is for problem solvers, the curious, for people who want to make things happen. Maybe you want to master Excel or learn negotiation tactics, build a website, learn how to podcast or edit video, or boost your Photoshop skills. You can go to lynda.com to feed your curious mind. It's a great way if you're interested in something and want to hone your skills, or you know, maybe you've just heard about something like programming, like Swift. Like, what is Swift? Well, how do I get my feet wet? Lynda.com is a great way to do that. With memberships, you get to watch and learn from top experts who are passionate about teaching. These videos are professionally done by experts in the field. It's not low quality. It is excellent. It is timely. They even have people from companies like Adobe help them with their lessons, so it's always up to date. You can structure your courses. You can do them at your own pace. You can do them on your computer, your iOS device, or anything in between. It's really great. And one thing I really love is that you can browse a course transcript to follow along. So you can have the video and then have the transcript kind of side by side and learn both ways. Maybe if you're like me, you know, you can read faster than you can watch a video. So it's really multifaceted. We want you to go check them out for a free 10-day trial. Visit lynda.com/connected. That's lynda.com/connected. We'd like to thank those guys for sponsoring this show and all of Relay FM. So guys, Uncle Tim's been in the news, I would say, last couple days.
Yeah.
Did you guys see this this article in Fortune about him? It's kind of like a mini profile.
Yeah, it's the one about his, you know, giving away all his money before he dies.
Yeah, basically.
Quite awesome. I didn't know he had a nephew, because this is the article when they. You know, they say he's giving away all his wealth and also paying for his nephew's tuition, college, right?
Yeah, which is I kind of like the contrast there. Like, oh, I'm putting my nephew through college, and then I'm going to give all the rest of my money away.
Yeah,
I mean, of course, that it's a pretty expensive college if that's a significant amount.
Yeah, it's like I'm going to go to a state technical school. No, I'd imagine his nephew's going someplace expensive, but The article is really interesting too. They obviously talk about that, and that's sort of the big subject. But they also talk sort of compare and contrast Tim Cook and Steve Jobs. And we're going to talk, I think, next week about the Becoming Steve Jobs book. But the Fortune writer really tried to like paint this picture of, you know, Jobs is always moving forward, and like Cook's Apple sometimes leaves things behind. And but then they have like a quote from Tim saying, "If you don't break away with the past, you can never move forward." And I thought it was really interesting to like compare and contrast the two leaders, and clearly they're very different, right? Like Tim is out there in the world in a way that Steve Jobs wasn't and didn't want to be. But I, for one, really like if you didn't like Tim Cook before this article, and you like, there's no way you can't not like him now, right? Like he's awesome.
I totally agree, but there's people who don't like him, which is interesting, you know, because there's people who say he's mixing the business with his own beliefs, you know, with his own ideas about politics and religion. And there's people who, especially I'm guessing, especially in America, who don't like this, you know, way of doing things. And instead, from my, again, I'm just guessing that things are different. But from my European perspective, I think this guy is doing, you know, really great stuff, because he's leading one of the biggest, if not the biggest company in the world. And he's using this kind of position, you know, this influence to, you know, to make meaningful changes that are not just, you know, bug fixes and performance improvements. It's actually stuff that matters.
Right.
And I mean, it's, again, like you said, it's awesome. Yeah, right. I agree.
So, yeah, so you're referring sort of to also to this Washington Post op-ed that Tim Cook wrote about some legislation that's gone on here that, you know, can open the door for discrimination based on sexual orientation and some other things. And so he basically is saying, like, this is dangerous, and I definitely agree with him. And there's definitely, like, conflict, I think, in parts of the country about this.
It's insane.
Oh yeah.
I don't know. Again, not the politics show, but it's insane.
Yeah. And I'm always struck when I read things that Tim Cook writes, and, you know, clearly they're edited and polished or whatnot, but it's so concise and so well written, you know, like his letter where he came out, I guess that was the end of last year. And then this essay in the Washington Post, just really well written, really well said. And I don't know about the two of you, but I definitely, like, read Tim Cook and I hear him in his voice. Do you guys do that?
Yeah, yes.
Yes. And I also see his face.
Wow.
At this point. Yeah, because, you know, I know what he's like. So I just pictured the guy talking to me.
Yeah.
Reading his
icon. I definitely did that in the Becoming Steve Jobs book. At the end, Tim Cook has some quotes, and I definitely read them in my head in his voice. Like, and it's, of course, easy for me because he is originally from he's from Georgia or Alabama somewhere, not far from me, so it's not hard for me to, like, imagine a southern accent.
Yeah, sometimes he does say words like you do.
Yeah,
I noticed this. Like, I'm not sure what the terminology is, but he has some kind of, you know, the vocals at the end of some words, they're, like, different from, you know, standard English. Or American English, I guess. Otherwise, Mike gets upset if I'm calling it standard.
Although I will say Mike sounds more American than ever. And sometimes...
But Mike used to sound more American.
Well, Mike... he's alive. But Mike sometimes says things like me. And, like, then I feel really guilty about that. It's like, oh, no. Because, like, he and I, as you might imagine, talk a lot off the air. Some weeks as much or more than we talk on the air together. So it's... I definitely have that influence on him, and that's no good for anyone, really. Not good at all. So we're going to get into the watch stuff. But before we do that, I want to talk about Screens. This episode of Connected is brought to you by Screens, which is a beautiful, powerful screen sharing client for OS X and iOS that lets you connect back to your computer from the comfort of your living room, the corner coffee shop, or anywhere in the world. It's really simple and easy to use. I've used Screens for years. It's so it works so much better than what OS X does by default. You can send and receive images, URLs, plain text, rich text, and so much more with remote Macs via clipboard sharing. So I can copy something here and paste it on the live streaming server for Relay, and it all just works really seamlessly. You can connect as a registered user or as a guest to a Mac, so you can help out a friend or relative without the need of their user credentials, which is really nice. It makes everyone feel more secure. And if you disconnect from a computer, you can even send on-disconnect actions like logging out, trigger a hot corner, etc. Screens also supports multiple displays, allowing you to access what you need no matter what display it's on. A lot of these tools are just limited to the primary display. But, you know, with a lot of people having more complicated setup, Screens adapts to that very easily. It's available on the iOS and Mac app stores. Like I said, I've used this for years. I use it to manage the Relay FM, the Mac Mini server we have at Mac Mini Colo. We have a Mac Mini hooked up to our television at home. I remote into that from the office and do things and take care of issues. And it's all just really straightforward. And the best part is Screens is on sale this week, 30% off the regular price. On iOS, it's usually $20. This week it's $14.99, and on the Mac, just $20.99. The sale ends May 10th, so go to the App Store now or go to screensapp.com to find out more. Thank you so much to Screens for sponsoring this week's episode of Connected. I love tools that work well. You know, it's just so great to have them on board. So, underscore.
Yes.
You agreed a couple days ago to come on. And my thought was we could talk about like Apple Watch apps beginning to show up. So like Evernote and, you know, a bunch of others had like an update and says, hey, you know, this includes support for Apple Watch. And then today, right, like an hour ago, Apple said, developers, you can submit your watch apps. So, hey, I'm a little confused between those two things. Like, I guess people were submitting just the iOS parts and not the watch code. But anyways, we have lots of questions for you. But I kind of wanted to start sort of broadly. There's this website that I'm sure you guys have seen called WatchAware.
Yeah.
WatchAware. And developers are submitting apps to this, or this site is going out and finding them and coming up with like basically a laundry list of watch apps. Have you guys looked through this? Like, do you have any thoughts on kind of what people are doing before we get into what underscore is doing?
Well, I think, at least initially, now, again, this is the reason why we have David today. But initially, we're going to see, based on these interactive demos and screenshots on this website, we're going to see a lot of similar apps, meaning that most of these apps, you know, use standard interface elements and, you know, they all have like the same basic structure and layouts. And I think it makes sense and it's obvious because, you know, developers are still learning. I mean, nobody knows what using a watch every day is like. And the simulator, of course, is no replacement for an actual watch. So most developers are playing it safe and, you know, going with the Apple guidelines and making apps that, you know, respect these guidelines. And my main, I wouldn't say concern, but, you know, curiosity would be to see, are these apps actually going to be useful on a daily basis? Because, you know, there's many limitations in WatchKit, which, again, I want to ask David about. But looking at these demos, I don't want to say that, you know, all these apps are going to be useless. But I'm curious if, you know, there's going to be too much similarity between apps or too little differentiation, maybe. David.
Yes.
Let me ask you. In building, so you have this awesome series on your blog called As I Learn WatchKit.
Yeah.
And in building, I don't know how many, like 20 or 30 watch apps, you have a full catalog of watch apps, basically.
I do.
In building watch apps, has it been a struggle for you to find ways to be original, to, you know, to take an iPhone app and to, you know, cut it down to an essential group of features that make sense on a watch?
I think there's two kinds of originality that are probably worth talking about separately. So the visual and sort of aesthetic similarities between WatchKit apps are in some ways coming from the way that WatchKit itself is structured and how constrained it is and how geared towards building, you know, there's only a certain number of UI elements that you can use, period, for building your applications. And we're all building with those same tools. And sort of like, you know, Apple gave us 6 crayons, and those are the only crayons we can use to draw our pictures. And so a lot of our pictures are going to have similarities to them. And so in that side, that side is a bit trickier to get out of. I think the distinctiveness that you can get in terms of the functionality, I think that's much easier in the sense because every app has a different purpose and a different usefulness. And while there are certain types of apps that I think apply, you know, lend themselves very strongly to being on the watch, you know, things where it makes sense to have something that you only look at for a few seconds or that is made more useful by being kind of always available to you. Like there's only so many things that falls into. But at least from my experience, I think that there's a lot of, you know, almost every app that I have has, when I, you know, if I think about it and I try and boil it down, there is some experience that would be made better by residing on a watch. And the hard part is just finding that thing and working, you know, and which is tricky, obviously, because we don't have them yet, but trying to think through what would I want to be able to access all the time? What would be the experience that is made better by doing that? And I'm sure we're going to find that we're going to have a bunch of apps that, you know, get launched on day one, and I'm sure some of mine will fall into this category, that in reality don't end up being as useful as our sort of our developer imaginations think they might be. And then we'll go through a process over the next few months of, you know, refining that, changing that, and, you know, honing in on what is actually going to be useful. But that's, I think, the process by which we're sort of trying to work out how each developer is just having to sort of find their own home in the watched landscape.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, and backing up a second about the visual consistency, I think part of that is good. You know, I think if you think back to the original iPhone, you know, Apple's bundled apps before the App Store, you know, there was a shared design language. Yes, there were outliers, but a lot of things, you know, looked and felt the same way. And I think that helped sort of guide the users, like, hey, I haven't used this particular app before, but I know what this type of button does. I think there's a value to that with the watch. And you know, maybe it's WatchKit holding people back, and maybe the SDK comes out, there'll be, you know, more options available to developers in terms of visual design. I think the other part of it is too, there was a post by Craig Hockenberry the other day about the actual display of the watch itself being an OLED display. Mm-hmm. Which basically, you know, they've done that because the blacks are really deep, and, you know, all the pictures you've seen of the watch and the black screen, it's kind of hard to tell where the LCD ends and the glass begins, and it's a much more sort of fluid experience from, you know, component to component. But there are trade-offs there. I would definitely recommend this article. But, you know, you look at these screenshots and everything is very, you know, based, you know, black background, white text, and you use your color for the information. And you know, there's going to be shrinks to that. And I think people who go real far outside of that, I wonder how well they would do, you know, if everyone else kind of stays within the same language.
Yeah. And I think what you said, though, there's also a significant part that is the training advantage, or like it's a different platform. And while people are used to doing things on iOS, you know, when we had the iPad, it's a new device or a new platform. Everything you'd learned on iOS applied directly to that experience. Whereas we're going to have to, or Apple and developers are going to have to teach people how to use it. And there is certainly an advantage to, there's only so many ways and so many structures that developers have for building apps. And so once you learn those, you'll know what to look for, and you'll know what little cues on the screen mean, you know, what it means when you have four dots at the bottom of the screen, or what it means when you push on something and a bunch of buttons appear. Like, that's probably just a helpful thing in terms of trying to get people used to a completely new way of interacting.
Mm-hmm. So maybe a couple of years down the road, they can start, you know, removing borders from buttons.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
You take the training wheels off. David, what do you think of, all these apps getting approved on the App Store before launch, and now Apple starting, you know, to open up some submissions for WatchKit apps today? What do you think of this, you know, time frame before the actual release date?
I think there's certainly a risk that Apple takes in doing that, insofar as obviously very few people have spent significant amounts of time with the Apple Watch outside of Apple. And so, you know, a lot of us are just guessing. A lot of us are, and I've spent a tremendous amount of time over the last few months working in, you know, the Apple Watch simulator and trying as best as I can to get used to it. But there's certainly a risk in terms of, I don't really know what it's going to be like to wear an Apple Watch day in and day out. But I think Apple was exactly right in terms of making sure that there is a rich, vibrant App Store as to whatever degree they can get it on launch day, in really many ways, getting ready for April 10th when like pre-orders and try-on and all that process starts, that they're able to show a variety of different experiences and a variety of different apps to people, and reviewers and people like that are going to be able to have a full experience. Because I think the watch, in a way that is probably more in a way that is more significant than your iPhone, the apps that you use and the apps that are useful to you to be on your watch is going to be very personal and very unique to you. You know, in the way that we all, you know, take pictures of our home screens and share them, like there's a lot of overlap, I think, between those. Whereas I think the watch will probably have a bit more, you know, distinctiveness to it, because what's useful to you and what is probably going to be very personal and very, very related to the life you lead and the things you do. And so having the more that they can do to have from the beginning, being able to show people a compelling experience is helpful. You know, if all they had were travel related apps, if all they had were, you know, airlines and hotels, well, if you don't travel, that's not very compelling and interesting to you. And so the more they can expand that out, I think makes sense. And, you know, this process that they're going through now of having the initial batch, I think, of kind of like the chosen few who were able to go through the process early. And then, you know, a few hours ago, they opened it up to the rest of us to start submitting our apps. I think it makes sense. And, you know, hopefully, I imagine they're expecting it that we're going to, you know, in a few weeks when in that big run up, there'll be a lot of apps, and I'm sure they'll brag about it. You know, they love saying they still do it with the iPad, and I'm sure they'll do it with the watch of, you know, hey, we have, I don't even know what the number is going to be. We have 10,000 watch apps available on day one. We have 5,000. We have 100,000. I mean, the scale of the app store is insane, so it's hard to predict how many they'll actually be. But I'm sure it's a number that's going to be big, and they're going to be proud of that. And
do you think there's any downside to having all these apps directly at launch? Do you think people can get confused, or do you think it's better for the platform to have all this choice right away?
I mean, there's certainly some risk of that. And I think there's also certainly a risk of, because those, you know, it would be bad for Apple if people, you know, downloaded new apps. They're like, oh, I got my new watch. I open it up, you know, I open up my iPhone, browse to the watch section, you know, of the App Store, and I get a bunch of apps. And turns out those apps aren't very good. That can hurt their initial impression of the watch in a way that could be damaging to their experience. Now, and it's in a way that's outside of their control. Like with the iPhone, when it launched, the advantage Apple had is for the first year, I guess, or plus or minus, everyone's experience on the iPhone was entirely curated and guided by Apple. It was only their apps, and that was the way it was. And so they could make sure that that was a quality experience. And so I think there's an even higher, there's an even higher bar that they're probably, I would hope in some ways, that they're going to have to apply. Like the risk that they're trying to mitigate is that people are going to get watch apps. If they're not very good, they can associate that with the watch and say, oh, the watch isn't actually as useful as I thought it would be, when it's really just the apps that they're using on it aren't quite at the level that they need to be and probably will be down the road.
Mm-hmm. What about the indie developer's point of view? Is it going to be more difficult to stand out on day one on the App Store because of all, you know, these options?
I honestly, it's hard to know. I think the thing that was very encouraging to me on that score is that Apple showed in the keynote, and you know, we can see now in 8.2 that the Apple Watch app on every iPhone running 8.2 or greater, like there's a tab that is the App Store, and as best as I can understand, only apps that have been updated to support the Apple Watch are going to show up there. And so for someone like me who looks at the App Store in general with 1.3, 1.4 million apps in it, to imagine a world where my apps are competing with probably just a few thousand to start with, whether that's 5,000, 10,000, 100,000, I don't really know, but there's probably only going to be a few thousand in there is, you know, that's delightful. That is, like when I saw that during the keynote, it was a Spring Forward event. That was amazing to me because that gives me a great opportunity to shine, because I'm competing with such a smaller pool. And, you know, it sort of reminds me in some ways of the old days of the App Store, where you know, if someone goes to that area and opens up a category, there may only be a handful of apps, or if they search for something in it, there's only going to be a handful of apps. And so being discovered in that is much more likely. And so that part of me is excited about it. And I want to be there on day one. You know, I have a bunch of apps that are going to be ready to be out there and to kind of see where that goes.
Yeah, the parallel to the sort of early days of the iOS App Store definitely comes to mind. And I can't help but think that, like we were making fun of the Netgear app at the top of the show, like apps like that clearly are never going to have a watch interface. Although, Federico, if you can turn your Wi-Fi off on your watch, that's going to open a whole new world of email for me.
Never say never.
I know. But I think, you know, for the type of user who's going to have a watch on day one, I think there's a real opportunity that, you know, say that I use product A, but product B has a watch app and I have a watch, then that might be enough for people to start switching between apps. And I think there's this real possibility for disruption in like some like app categories that have been pretty buttoned up for a while. So I think any developer worth their salt, I think, is definitely, you know, doing what we're taking time out of your day, you know, what you would be doing, David, to get there on day one in that small pool. And yeah, I can't help but think that that could be a pretty interesting, you know, break point in the history of the App Store. You know, having these things siphoned off into their own little silos is something new for Apple. So I'm excited to see where that ends up.
Yeah, and I think there are increasingly few opportunities like that. You know, more for the independent software developer side of things, where it's, you know, the thing that I have in going in my favor that a bigger software company doesn't is the fact that I can do whatever I want, and I don't need approval. I don't need, you know, like a big process to do that. And so once I decided a couple months ago that, like, you know, I'm going to make lots of watch apps, I'm going to focus on it, it's going to be kind of my full time focus for from when WatchKit was announced until now, I'm able to really focus on that and make it happen in a way that, you know, you could imagine that there will be some you know, a variety of my competitors who are more slow moving because they have to take a more wait and see approach. They're like, well, are we going to put all this effort into building a watch app, and then if Apple doesn't sell a lot of watches, then, you know, it's not going to work, or there's that kind of bureaucracy about it. And so I'm hopeful, you know, fingers crossed, that there's going to be a bit of a first mover advantage in that way. But, you know, who knows? Time will tell.
Yeah. Let's take a quick break and talk about our third sponsor today, which is Wealthfront. Wealthfront is the automated investment service that makes it easy to invest your money the right way. Wealthfront software manages your money using investment strategies that were previously only available to the wealthiest of investors, so not guys like us, for just one quarter of the cost using of a traditional advisor. Wealthfront monitors your account 24/7, automatically rebalancing your portfolio, reinvesting dividends, and working to maximize your post-tax returns. Wealthfront is overseen by a team of investment experts, the same experts who launched the index fund revolution and who have written some of the most important books in finance. In case you're still not convinced, you should know that Wealthfront manages over $2 billion in client assets and has saved millions of dollars on taxes for its clients. So with Wealthfront watching over your investments every day, what will you do with all that extra time? Visit wealthfront.com/connected to get your first $10,000 managed for free. Wealthfront, Inc. is an SEC-registered investment advisor. Brokerage services are offered through Wealthfront Brokerage Corporation, member FINRA and SIPC. This is not a solicitation to buy or sell securities. Investing in securities involves risk, and there is a possibility of losing money. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. Please visit wealthfront.com to read their full disclosure.
Yeah, also drink responsibly.
It's true. That's also really good advice. So good. Yeah. Man, this is just, we're helping people here on Connected. So David, you know, you talking about before the break, you know, you sort of made this deliberate decision to spend time on watch apps because you're a one man band. You know, you get to do that, and so kind of what have you been learning about WatchKit itself? You know, we talked a little bit about maybe visual consistency, but what should users be expecting as far as types of functionality out of these apps?
So at a first glance, it's probably useful to say that there's three kinds of WatchKit apps that developers can make at this point. They can make essentially rich or interactive notifications. So you get a notification on your phone, it shows up on your watch, and you can interact with it. Maybe the simple sort of canonical example is you get a meeting invitation and you can accept or decline it. You know, and so it's interactive rather than just telling you something, you can do something with it. The second kind are glances, which are little read-only widgets that are available if you swipe up from the clock face on the watch. And these are entirely static in terms of they're not interactive. Their purpose is just to display, you know, useful information to the user in a way that's sort of in some ways not unlike today widgets on the iPhone, especially today widgets that aren't, you know, sort of the big, you know, like launcher or these things that caused all that controversy in the first place, things that are just, you know, showing you data. They kind of fit into that kind of venue. And then lastly, there are sort of WatchKit apps, which are actual, you know, apps you would launch from your watch's home screen. And these are apps that, you know, you can do a bit more with, that you can make interactive, that can the user can, you know, have a longer engagement with. And the thing that probably that's important to keep in mind is they, all of these apps run, or at least Glances and WatchKit apps run on your iPhone. And all of the logic, all of the programming and all that heavy work is done on your phone and is being just sort of shipped up to the watch for display. So you can't, there is at this point no WatchKit, no watch, third-party watch apps that will run without a connected iPhone, you know, close by. And as a result, you know, there's a lot of limitations that come from that in terms of what I was talking about, you know, the UI consistency and things there. Apple is very, I think, in a very intelligently, but very strongly pared down what is possible, the types of things that you can do, the types of interactions that you can create, because everything, you know, you hit a button on your watch, that button press is being sent over Bluetooth to your phone. Your phone is responding to it, doing whatever it needs to do, and then it sends back to the watch, hey, as a result of that, you need to update the UI this way, which is a very disjointed process compared to on an iPhone, where obviously, you know, you tap the screen and all of the processing and everything is done entirely locally. And so it's a very streamlined process that, you know, isn't rich and graphical and fluid in a sort of an interactive way.
Gotcha. The what's interesting to me about those three types, like you look at that that website we mentioned earlier with all the apps, and even look at what you're doing, that's not as limiting as it seems. Like, you know, from the outside, and maybe your experience is different, but it seems to me, at least, that I don't know how many users would really realize that it was so limited. You know, because there doesn't really be flexibility within those constraints.
Yes, definitely. I mean, when I was first speculating, you know, after the watch was announced, but before WatchKit was announced, when I was sort of speculating about what I thought they would allow us to do, I thought we would be much more limited than we are currently. Like, we can build pretty interesting applications that, you know, can do actual work for the user starting on day one before anyone's even seen, you know, and anyone's ever bought a watch. And so that's pretty cool. And I think there are certainly some odd cases, you know, the weird things, like if you leave your phone in one room and you walk away and you try and use the app, it's not going to work. But beyond those kind of odd edge cases, like the fact that it's running on your phone and it has this kind of very streamlined life cycle that it can have is in some ways just an implementation detail. And most users probably won't know that or at least care about that. But I think you're certainly right in that there's not a lot of things that I want to do that I can't. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of things that I want to do that would be better with a native app that mm-hmm. you could, you know, would be more fluid and more performant and have few weird, you know, sort of performance characteristics. But at its core, other than things that are offline, sort of in their nature, like say you wanted to, you know, play a podcast from your watch, that kind of thing you can't do now. If it was, you know, now you have to do that kind of thing based on your phone. But beyond those kinds of offline capabilities, there's really not much that you can't do fundamentally.
Are there any software features, you know, that third-party developers cannot access? Like, can you access the heart rate sensor? Can you access the haptic feedback in third-party apps, or are those limited to just to Apple software?
Probably the best way to think about it, and A, well, firstly, you can't access those types of things. And really, the best way to think about it is like a WatchKit app is really an iPhone app that happens to have a view that's being projected onto the watch. Yeah. And so there's really no local access or interactivity or things. You can't make it, you know, the haptics thing. You can't play sounds from the watch. You can't play, I mean, it's unless, yeah, like in WatchKit, everything is done from the phone.
And you just have touch on the watch.
Yep. Yeah. The only point that I get is when, like, I have interactivity when someone taps something, basically. And that's really all the interaction I have. And so a lot of things that you're doing, like, you can still make that work. There's a lot of powerful things you can do from your phone. But nothing that's actually just watch specific is going to be available, at least to start with.
Mm-hmm. Do you think WatchKit and this, you know, initial wave of watch apps is the right move from Apple, or should have they waited for a native SDK? Do you think it is right to give developers the tools to make, you know, limited apps in a way, and then later update those apps with better features and technologies? Or maybe, I don't know, I guess we'll know with time, but as a developer, what's your point of view on these, you know, limitations right now?
I mean, I think it's better than the suite solution we had for the iPhone.
Okay.
Which is, I think, the reality that, like, I'm encouraged by. Like, I could imagine, obviously, I always want everything as soon as I can. If I could make native apps for the Apple Watch, and I, you know, I would have been doing it. I would have been all in on building native apps. And so I'll take whatever I can get. But I'm very glad that they didn't take an approach that was incredibly limited and incredibly constrained. And I think it's ultimately a strategic move by Apple, because they're trying everything they can to, you know, they're essentially inventing a new, or they're trying to forge out into a brand new platform in a brand new way and a brand new user base. And so they're needing to make that as compelling as they can. And one of the ways that they can do that is by having third-party apps. And so I think they're trying as far as they can to make rich, compelling third-party apps available from the beginning. And, you know, there's certainly pros and cons in that, that it's a very, the way they're doing it is incredibly elegant insofar as, like, it's incredibly battery, you know, respectful. Like, way in which I'm not running any code on the watch. I don't have the ability to do something that's, like, going to run down the user's battery in many ways. Like, all I can do is say, display this text, show this picture. Like, there's things that I can do that may, in the long term, have, you know, slightly, if the user's using the watch all the time and, you know, working with my apps, it's going to use their battery. But it avoids this whole realm of possibilities that truly native applications could, you know, could bring with it. And I think that's really clever and really elegant that they're finding this interesting way to kind of have a balance between locking it down totally and saying, no, only Apple apps are going to be here. And the other extreme of saying, you know, anybody can make anything. This kind of balanced middle ground is, I think, very clever and very elegant and accomplishes most of the goals and the advantages that they'd be wanting without a lot of the downside and a lot of the sort of the problems that either other extreme would include.
And what have the cons been during your development time?
I mean, I think the biggest challenges are because we have, like, there are so many things that you are I just take for granted on you know, on work developing for the iPhone, like doing an animation, you know, on the iPhone. Like, the iPhone, almost every iPhone app, just out of the box, can do so many richly animated and lively and engaging experiences that on the watch are really hard to do, just because of the way that they're structured and the way that they're, you know, they're running in this strange disconnected, you know, thing where the watch talks to the phone talks to the watch. And so you don't have the ability to make things quite as fluid in the way that you're used to. And so the challenges that I've had is to try and still make, you know, compelling, interesting applications in that context has been much more difficult. And, you know, I'll run into things where it's like, oh, wouldn't it be great if I could do this? Or it's like, if only I could access more than just when the user pushes a button, you know, what happens when they push their finger down or those types of things. Like, not having access to that can, you know, is a bit, you know, it's constraining. And it's in some ways nice because it focuses the mind and it means that we have to do things and find creative solutions to, you know, the problems we're solving. We can't just sort of do the easy stuff. But I think the biggest difficulty has just been trying to make apps that are, you know, have that interest and have that degree of polish is a bit more difficult, I think, at least at this point.
Yeah, but I mean, I think a good example of some of that polish, you have a post up on your site about Pedometer Plus Plus, and you're talking about, you know, different ways that you could display the user's you know, their goal and where they are, you know, in your step counting application. And I really find, you know, the second animation you have, you know, the bars kind of coming from the bottom and they're very playful. Yeah. And you know, it's crazy to me reading this, you know, how you're doing it, that it's all getting pushed as a series of images basically from a phone.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
But I think that level of like playfulness and sort of like just little polished touches are going to, as important as they are on iOS, I think they're going to be so much more important on the watch because it's so small, because, you know, you're only using it for a couple of seconds at a time. And so it kind of, it's kind of like each view, each interaction really counts much more, I think, than on an iOS app. Sort of, you know, how has it been, you know, kind of working on those limitations in something like animation, or, you know, being able to polish something with a, you know, simpler set of tools than you have on the phone?
Yeah, it's, there's definitely a strange mentality that you have to get into, I found, when you're working on watch apps, because for most apps, your goal is to minimize the time that the user will be looking at your app, or at least making it so that the app is immediately useful in a way that if they only opened the app for a second or two, it would still have been a meaningful interaction. Mm-hmm. In some ways. And that, I think, is an interesting challenge from a design perspective, because you can't be lazy in a way that you can often get away with. You know, if you're developing an app for, you know, a 6 Plus, like you have a tremendous amount of information that you can just sort of throw on the screen and let the user have to kind of wade their way through it. Or you can just throw lots of buttons on the screen and, you know, they can find what they want to use. Like, you have such a tiny amount of space and you have such a tiny amount of the user's attention, because the expectation and, you know, the way all of the Apple's guidelines around this tend to be, you know, sort of driving you towards, is that your users are expected to only interact with your application for seconds at a time. And so it's really complicated to make sure that you're able to really make that impact in that short amount of time. And you've boiled down the utility of what you're doing to those just bare essentials that are useful. It's still useful. It's still, you know, it's still actually solving a problem or meeting a need, but it's doing it in a way that only takes 2 seconds. And that certainly is a different mindset that you have to get into. And it's especially kind of odd in some ways coming from over the last summer where all the phones got bigger and bigger. And so suddenly I was trying to deal with the problem of, like, what do I do with all this extra space? Now you're instead going the complete opposite direction and saying, what do you do when you have a display that is maybe a quarter of the original of, like, a, you know, an iPhone 4 screen or something like that? You know, it's a really small amount of data that you have to work with.
Right. And kind of the flip side is, you know, I think when I think about how I might use it, it's when I'm walking, when I'm doing something else with my hands, something comes in, and I don't want to have to wait, right, for like someone's cute animation to finish. So I think that balance is going to be something that I think a lot of developers are going to have to tweak as time goes on, as you know, expectations shift around that use case. And you know, maybe it is that we're going to be using these for 5 or 10 seconds as opposed to 2 or 3 seconds the way we think now. So I think it'll be you know, I think there'll be an evolution there, maybe as people kind of settle into usage habits. So kind of to head towards wrapping up. What, you know, David, what specifically are you working on that you, you know, would like to share? I know you've written a lot about this. You know, what kind of out of your library of apps has you excited about the watch?
Sure. So I have a watch kit update for most of my major apps. You know, so I have for my recipe organizer, my recipe book, I have a thing for managing your grocery list from your wrist, which seemed the most sort of compelling thing for me to be able to just, you imagine walking through a store and, you know, you can check things off and add things to a list just from your wrist. You know, I have some audio-based things. I have a podcast client and an audiobook client. And for them, it's about being able to, you know, navigate around either what you're listening to, you know, in terms of, you know, skipping ahead, skipping back, or switching to something else all without having to, you know, get your phone out. Or, you know, I have a feed reader, Feed Wrangler, which for there, it's trying to be able to, you know, quickly browse headlines and articles and, you know, just with doing that with in a context where you can just pick up, you know, raise your wrist, flip up the glance and, you know, see what's going on. And if, you know, with pedometer, it's, you know, taking your current step count data and moving it onto your wrist and displaying it in a way that, you know, it's just even easier to see and to see where you are and to see, you know, how active you've been. You know, that in some ways it was easier for my existing apps to just kind of look at them and say, how would this be better on a watch? And then, you know, for a bunch of other apps, things that I'm not quite at the point of announcing yet, that are other apps that I've been working on that are just trying to think through things that I think would be cool and just, you know, starting from the ground up and building new apps for that.
And, you know, we've talked a lot about the last couple of weeks about the watch, you know, specifically, you know, which one we're looking at purchasing, kind of how our friends and family view it. You know, as you've been working on this, what's the feedback been like from people? You know, do friends and family kind of look at you and, you know, and look at the watch and sort of, you know, shake their head, or are people generally excited about it that you've come across?
I think the most interesting thing that I've run into when I talk to like friends and family, sort of people who aren't in the, you know, the iOS development world, is that everybody's interest in the watch is different and they have very different motivations and reasons for why they think it would be cool. And for some people, it's about fitness. For some people, it's about messaging. For some people, it's about notifications. For some people, it's about, you know, business stuff and calendaring and for travel. Like everyone I've talked to seems to have a very unique picture of when they imagine what having, you know, it's like, and I tend to describe it as sort of like, it's kind of like squeezing down an iPhone and putting it on your wrist, which is only sort of right, but it's much more easier to explain it that way than to kind of really get into what it is. Everyone puts a different thing onto it. Like, I know my wife is most excited about the fitness stuff. Like, she wears a Jawbone up band, but there's a lot of things about it that drive her crazy, and she'd love to have something that can track her workouts and to have a more, you know, sort of integrated version of it that she can wear all the time, that's fashionable enough to do in that way. But that's different than other people I know who, when they think about it, they're like, man, they see all the silly, you know, connectivity and messaging types of things where, you know, you can draw pictures to each other or tap your loved one on the wrist. And that's what's compelling to them. And what's interesting about that is I really think it is, everyone's going to be different and everyone has a different reason for why they might want one. And so in some ways that's kind of I'm sure Apple has their work cut out in terms of, it's harder to have a compelling narrative about that. Or a straightforward narrative anyway of like, you need an Apple Watch because of X, mm-hmm. because that's going to be different for everybody.
Right.
And the thing that's going to resonate with them is going to be different. And so they're having to find, you know, you can see it even in their marketing, like they're going in all these different directions to try and make sure that people understand like, oh, it can do this and it can do this and it can do this. And you can find whichever one of those fits for you.
Right. And, you know, even thinking back, you know, Apple had this, back in 2007, a series of advertisements, you know, there were TV ads here in the States, and it was, you know, maybe 30 seconds of just the mail application, right? So you just saw an iPhone and then like floating dismembered hand doing email or in Maps or in Safari making a phone call. You know, we've even talked about it here where that idea that the marketing seems really scattershot, you know, it's worrisome to some people. But the more I think about it and the longer this goes on, it really is like the original iPhone where they had to explain that, you know, this isn't like just a regular phone with an iPod taped to it. It does all these other things. And some people are going to be really excited about email. Some people are going to be really excited about Safari. And they had to tell that story sort of in a pattern, like blending all these things together with the phone. And, you know, now it's only more complicated because we all know how smartphones work, right? So they have to explain, like you said, it's like squeezing an iPhone down, but it's really not like that at all. And it does all these different things. And I'm not nearly as worried about like the marketing or like Apple's narrative around it as I was before the spring event. And even in the couple weeks since, I feel like they're doing what they need to do and that that's okay. That there are people who are going to be really interested in it for very different reasons. And I think long-term that's great because if they can hit all those audiences and that's, you know, a bigger usage base for, you know, developers, a bigger customer base for Apple is good as well. But, yeah, I think that's really, really well said.
What's your reason, David, to get a watch besides, you know, making apps?
The things that I'm most excited about and looking forward to, I think are, and it's probably sorry for to say, take a step back and say, as soon as they announced the Apple Watch, I went and got a bunch of different wearable type of things. And then the thing that's mm-hmm. closest to an Apple Watch that I got was a Microsoft Band, yeah. Which, you know, is a reasonable device, but nothing special. And the things that I found that were most compelling to me were the messaging side of things. So like being able to never miss a notification, you know, if a notification comes in, like I have very few notifications turned on my phone. Like if my phone buzzes, it's because one of my servers exploded or because, you know, someone I care about is trying to get a hold of me. And so I loved that I finally, like the feeling of not having to worry about missing those was just really reassuring. And I think it helped me to use my phone less because I didn't constantly pick it up and just, you know, wake the screen to see if there was any missed notifications. And so that kind of thing that the watch can do in a way that's way more, you know, deep and rich than anything, you know, a Microsoft Band or a Pebble or anything can do because it's, you know, it's built into the core OS. Like that thing, that side of things, I think is very compelling to me. And then I'm excited about, I mean, since I've started wearing all these bands, like the fitness tracking side of it is very compelling to me. I enjoy having like a picture of what I'm doing, you know, when I work out, seeing my heart rate, seeing how hard I worked out, you know, in the middle of a workout, looking down and seeing like, am I really working out or I just feel like I'm working out and those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And so those two things are what I'm looking forward to most.
Nice.
You have a model picked out?
Well, I can cheat a little bit because I'm a developer. It's like, I'm buying one of each size, not of each model, but of each size. Right. And then I'm probably just going to get the ones that looked best to me is just I'll probably get a black, sport in, you know, the 38 and the 42. Gotcha. Just because I mean, that's the funny thing too, being a developer is I will probably own, you know, several like dozen Apple Watches over the course of the next few years. And mm-hmm. so like, it's easy for me to say, like, I'm probably just going to get the sport because it's a little bit less, but that little bit of difference will add up over the years. You know, at this point, I think, you know, it's like I own, you know, a dozen iPhones and
right.
it's like a lot of times for an iPhone, I get, you know, I get smaller capacities than I would otherwise, because I know I'm only going to use it for a year and then I'll get a new one. And so I don't have quite the same problem of, you know, having years and years of photos building up or those kinds of things. And so I'm just going to get, you know, a pair of sports. At this point, I expect to, you know, pre-order them as soon as I can, you know, if I have to wait up till 3 a.m. to do that, or however they manage pre-orders, and then just, you know, see them and go from there.
Yeah. Maybe in a few years, you'll have your entire arm full of watches. It'll be like the RoboCop of Apple Watch users.
Exactly.
Just keep wearing watches on your entire arm. And, I mean, yeah, it makes sense, I guess, from a developer's perspective to have, you know, better access to as many units as possible. I was kind of wishing you would say you're getting all the addition models. I'm wishing you all the success on the App Store, David.
Yeah.
So you'll be able to buy addition test units.
Well, let's put it this way. If my watch apps do just wildly well, maybe that then I'll be able to afford an edition, and I can go in and use my watch money to buy buy a watch, and Apple can just complete the cycle there, and it's like the money they give me just goes right back into them, and maybe when they say it's a gold rush, you know, that kind of thing, it's like the goal is actually to get gold at the end of it.
Wow. Well, David, thank you so much for coming on today. Where could people find you on the internet?
Sure. I'm underscore David Smith on Twitter. And you can find me, I have a blog at david-smith.org, which has a bunch of writing, including all my WatchKit series.
Awesome. So thank you, everyone, for listening. If you want to find show notes this week, you can point your browser to relay.fm/connected/33. You can find Federico Vitici at the glorious macstories.net and Vitici on Twitter. You can find me at 512pixels.net and ISMH on Twitter. Until next time, say goodbye, gentlemen.
Arrivederci.
Goodbye.